There's only one blood, cause it ain't no sense in us trampling on the stones. It's us, down, down to the bone. Blood is thick, waters were known well, cousins were kept apart, mothers were off, memories. Fathers were not favored on the farm, for he could do some harm, he could wreck the master scheme, for he, brothers, could dream. Your mama ain't no saint, your daddy died in a shallow stream, but your uncle Dr. King did have a dream, my brother. And what is your real excuse? Why can't you study your lessons and stay in school? Why can't you study your lessons and stay in school?
Homeboy by Soonchi Ali. Welcome to the Qumran Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, coming at you live from Morris Media Studios. Our call-in number is 1-323-293-3375. This week on the Qumran Report, we will interview some of the cast members from the Daughters of the Kush, the must-see play everybody's talking about, now running at the Stella Adler Theater in Hollywood. And here's a clip about the play.
Presents the Daughters of the Kush, a world premiere from the Ruby Theater Company's playwright George Corbin. The play is set on Midwestern college campus in 1963, a black sorority encouraging new pledgees until a request from a white co-ed challenges the concept of sisterhood. October 13th through October 29th, Friday and Saturday, 8 p.m. Sunday matinees, 3 p.m. at the Stellar Adler Theater, 6773 Hollywood Boulevard. Reservations and information, call 213-908-5032 or get your tickets by visiting corbincush.eventbrite.com. GWC Productions presents The Daughters of the Kush, a world premiere from the Roby Theater Company's playwright George Corbin. The play is set on Midwestern college campus in 1963, a black sorority encouraging new pledgees until a request from a white co-ed challenges the concept of sisterhood. October 13th through October 29th, Friday and Saturday, 8 p.m. Sunday matinees, 3 p.m. at the Stellar Adler Theater, 6773 Hollywood Boulevard. Reservations and information, call 213-908-5032 or get your tickets by visiting corbincush.eventbrite.com.
Okay, the Daughters of the Kush continues its run at the Stellar Adler Theater Friday, October the 27th. Runs Friday and Saturday at 8 p.m. and Sunday at 3 p.m. Ends its run on Sunday, October the 29th. The Stellar Adler Theater is located at 6773 Hollywood Boulevard, 90028. Ticket information and reservation, 1-213-908-5032. I'm delighted to have with us in the studio playwright George Corbin and one of the actresses from the play, Charlotte Williams, and one of the consultants on the production, Kurt Maxey. Welcome to the Qumran Report.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's start off with the playwright George Corbin. George, what is the message of the Daughters of the Kush?
Well, at its essence, the Daughters of the Kush is a cautionary tale specifically aimed at, I think, African-American organizations we value who provide support and meet the challenge, especially in education, with our African-American youth, male and female. While the play is, in my mind, when I wrote it, more about African-Americans being put into a position where loyalty to a group identity, the love of an organization that provides support, camaraderie, in this case sisterhood, is challenged by an ethical decision. And we're one at a young age, 19, 20, 21, these women, have to make a choice. What do they advance? The personal values or protection of this valued organization?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know one of the questions that came up during the talk back a number of times when they found out that you was in a fraternity is why did you write about a sorority instead of a fraternity?
As I mentioned at the time, women are a lot more interesting, a lot more complex. The emotional opportunity, the emotions to mine, just to me seemed a little more appealing. And, of course, the catalyst for the play, as I've mentioned previously, was a African-American sorority whose hazing or pledging activities resulted in a death and a resistance to perhaps helping the authorities. So it was a sorority in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, what are your thoughts about the first 2 weeks of the run?
Well, I've been very pleased, of course, being there from the get-go and and watching these wonderful actors evolve. The play has gotten better, quite frankly, mm-hmm. as time has gone on, which shouldn't be a surprise. Mm-hmm. We've tweaked a few things, but the overall performance of the actors in bringing to life the characters I had in my head and reaching those emotional points that I hope connected with the audience. I've been extremely pleased. Mm-hmm. Charlotte.
I've been pleased as well.
Okay.
What are some of the benefits of joining a fraternity or sorority? Can you talk about that for a while?
Well, I joined Alpha Phi Alpha at Penn State in 1961, and there were very few African Americans on campus. I was vaguely aware of Alpha Phi Alpha, but what attracted me was initially these young men, even though few in number, seemed to be focused, engaged, in many cases held positions of authority on campus way outside of what their numbers would have suggested. It was a place that kept me as a black young man focused on my education, provided a supportive environment, and most of all, provided a source of pride.
You was a freshman at the time?
I was a freshman. But the value of Alpha Phi Alpha, along with the other predominantly black fraternities and sororities today, greater than ever, mm-hmm. is to bridge that gap mm-hmm. of young black men going into college and actually graduating. Mm-hmm. And I want to emphasize that the support of a traditional black fraternity and sorority, the involvement causes one to continue that focus towards graduation mm-hmm. because your peers mm-hmm. are encouraging you, you study together, you must maintain your grades, else your chapter will mm-hmm. slide away. All those things propel and increase the odds of you actually graduating.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let me ask you this. We never talked about this before, about your journey to Penn State. How did you end up in Penn State?
Well, as you may remember, I was born in Bermuda and I grew up there. My father was born in New York in 1913. But he met my mother in Bermuda, and that was my British elementary and secondary education, but I was the eldest of three boys. So when it came to college, quite frankly, they were biased, the system. They wanted you to go to college in England. And if you couldn't go to England, you'd go to Canada, like Queen's University, University of Toronto. And if you couldn't get anywhere else, go to the United States. That kind of thinking. I picked a large university. I had no idea what I was going to major in, but it had to be close to the East Coast. Philadelphia had relatives and friends. So it was pure luck that – but the financial aspect played a role because I had two brothers coming after me. We had to look at that.
What advice would you give us, some youngsters coming up to you, a male or female, that is interested in joining a fraternity or a sorority?
Well, I guess it's like falling in love to some degree, you know. You can study all you want. I would recommend that one study the history of these institutions collectively and look at those leaders, those famous products of that particular sorority or fraternity, and take a look at their intake process. What does it emphasize? If it emphasizes the things that you are interested in or resonate with you, of course, you socialize, you get to know them. And, you know, it's a connection type of thing. I feel more comfortable with this group. That doesn't mean the fraternity overall would be a good fit. But perhaps that chapter and you gradually start on that process. But research, talking to people you respect who have some knowledge, both members of the fraternity sorority and those who have elected not to get into this unique world of black fraternities and sororities, and listen.
Okay, I got a couple more questions, but I'm going to let Kirk get in. But let me ask you one more. Go ahead, Kirk.
You can go ahead.
Okay, one more question. Minton, that started the first black fraternities, that was patterned after Skull and Bones at Yale. And it seems like a lot of the white fraternities have stronger contacts after they leave college, you know, in terms of business, in terms of helping each other. Do you see the same thing with most of the black fraternities? I know the Alphas is known for them, but I'm wondering about the so-called Divine Nine as a whole.
This is totally subjective, and this has been my experience talking to him. With 55 years in the fraternity, having come from a business environment and been involved with various business organizations, I do think that, and I'm speaking primarily from my years in Ventura County and to some degree LA, there is that connection and support, jobs, you network via job, not what the – you're not going to see those ads in the paper. So you got a call from your alpha buddy at Amgen. They're looking for an HR person or a lab specialist or whatever. I get emails – from the AKs, and Delta's in Ventura County, and our brothers share periodically job opportunities. And then here are the movers and the shakers. I don't know whether overall the black fraternities and sororities do a so-called better job than those fraternities. I think it's more a factor of the university you attended. Like USC has a phenomenal networking. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it has to do with the unique institution emphasizing it. So it permeated through the fraternities and so forth.
During the sometimes during the perform after the performances, somebody might ask me, "Well, why you have this Plains College? Why wasn't it at a black college with a black sorority? Was there any sort of significance about that of the location?"
Well, like most playwrights, you pull on what you know and your experience and background. Obviously, my undergraduate study at Penn State, where we knew we had 127 African-Americans on campus out of 24,000, and who they were and which fraternities. That sense of isolation, being a small black unit within a much larger white context. It could have been Pennsylvania. Yeah. I just picked Iowa.
Okay. I was just asked that because several times people ask me, why wasn't it at Howard or so on and so forth? Mm-hmm. And it makes sense. To me, I went to a small college for a year, Occidental College, and it only had about 1,500 students, and maybe 200 were black. So I was just curious.
Is that the one President Obama went to?
Yeah, yeah. Temporarily.
Let's see who's on the phone. We got a phone call. Who am I speaking with, please?
Hi.
Hello, who am I speaking with?
You're speaking with Alicia Murray. I play Rhonda in the show.
Yeah, Alicia, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Fine. This is the great actress, Alicia. She played Rhonda. You have a question for George or Charlotte?
No, I really just wanted to call in and show some support, guys, and make sure people know to come out this Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. We'll be closed, but I guess I'll pose the question that people have been posing to me. Are you looking into developing this show in the future, people are bringing it back?
Well, first of all, do we look good or what? You're supposed to say, yeah.
You look good.
I don't know. I don't know. We're going to get together and do our postmortem, of course, after the end of the run this Sunday, and we will be talking about whether or not there is life for the Daughters of the Kush beyond this weekend. Mm-hmm.
George, what questions do you have for Alicia?
Well, Alicia, I'm most interested, and I have enjoyed watching all the actors explore their roles. I'm curious as to what you found most appealing about your role. This key person who changes the arc of her experience as the loving daughter, sister, and yet at the end of the play, she's somewhere else in her experience.
I think what is interesting, you said it yourself, is the arc of her personality. But really, she doesn't change. It's everyone around her that changes. Mm-hmm. She is always the moral compass from the beginning to the end. Mm-hmm. She's always looking for the right thing. She's looking at people as who they are, and she's looking at the sorority itself for the ideals that the sorority represents, you know, that truth, the honor, and all that type of thing is what she joined for. So once those ideals of the sorority started to shift because mm-hmm. of the circumstances, and once the people who she considered her closest sorors or daughters, fellow daughters, started to shift their stances based off of the circumstances, then all of a sudden that arc became clear, because it went from happy-go-lucky, you know, I'm just out here enjoying life, seeing people for who they are, to I'm still the moral compass, but everything else has shifted. Everyone else is not doing what I feel is right. So for her, really, you see her internal struggle a lot, especially in the show, and you get to see the journey, which is why I think a lot of people resonate so much with the Rhonda character, because you kind of see the shift in how she responds to everything mm-hmm. so drastically from the beginning to the end.
So Charlotte, since you play Rhonda too, what would you like to ask Alicia about the role?
Oh, hey, Alicia.
Hey.
Well, I guess, did you find, because me and Lisa, we have talked, and we both love Rhonda so dearly. And like Lisa said, her moral compass is so strong and resonates with both of us. Like, we feel like she is close to the vest. Mm-hmm. Did you ever at one point, though, felt like judgment towards Rhonda when she makes the decision that she does to go along?
That's a good question. I don't want to say the word judgment, because that's such a strong word. Mm-hmm. But I think that Rhonda herself judges herself. I mean, it's obvious in her actions. She doesn't come back to school.
Right.
She doesn't really, you know, really deal with her daughters the way she did previous to the incident.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see her actions. It's like she's beating herself up and trying to make amends.
Yeah.
So it's like you can't judge her from the outside looking in, because she's really the only person doing what's right. But I do think that the scenario that it happens in this play will affect Rhonda for the majority of her life.
Yeah.
And I think it will affect how she responds to people with who she brings in. So if anything, it's like I don't judge her, but I know that that decision is going to play a part in almost everything she does going forward.
She's like deeply disappointed in herself.
Mm-hmm. But exactly.
Like you said, that because of that and that choice that she made, it'll never happen again. In her life, you know, in watching who she brings into her circle and into her surroundings, because I completely agree with Lisa. She didn't change. Rhonda stayed grounded. She stayed, you know, loving and accepting of all people. Mm-hmm. But the people and the reason that she joined the sorority, like Lisa said, is all the same because of knowledge and truth and honor. And then those values shifted. And so then she shifted, you know, she mm-hmm. her because of her environment changed around her. She had to change from her environment, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kurt.
Okay. How?
For Alicia.
Okay. For both of the mm-hmm. Rhondas. Okay, we have this shift of environment, and I think she's the strongest character in the play.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, yes, she is beating up on herself, but she is the one that's in the right.
Oh yeah.
And so, it's almost as if the sorority has morphed into not one unit. But two,
mm-hmm.
and Rhonda is, you know, the way I was resonating and relating to Rhonda's part, she was good. She was more in the right. Everybody else, they're thinking about themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, yeah. You know, there's no way to get around it.
Mm-hmm.
Carla.
Clara.
Clara, mm-hmm. the head of the queen. She's looking 20, 30 years down the road, and we don't know what's going to happen 20, 30 years down the road. I think Rhonda really sees the immediacy of what this thing does to her, and that grabbed me. I really like that in the way scenes were staged with her and, mm-hmm. and everything throughout the play. So mm-hmm. I just wondered, did both of you actors feel that while you're on the stage?
Yeah, I enjoy playing her a lot. She's definitely one of my favorite characters that I've gotten to play on stage. She's one of my favorite characters in the show. A lot of people will look at the lead, like Clara, and think, oh, that's fun, I get to be me. You know, but I think it's something interesting in being the character you want the whole audience to fall in love with, because yeah. I make that a challenge for myself every show. Is okay, someone has to fall in love with me tonight, whether it is I make them laugh or cry. And like for you, Charlotte, I know you've had the amazing experience of getting to do both. Mm-hmm. So how is that for you to switch?
Yeah. You know, it's
and you sleep at night.
You know, I sleep the nights that I play Rhonda, and then I stay up the nights I play Claire. No, for me, similar, because I started off with Rhonda, and so I had judged Clara so harshly to make the towards the end of the play the reasons why Rhonda has shifted her, you know, feelings towards her best friends, because they were best friends in the beginning of the play. And so, you know, for all of this stuff to come out, and I had, you know, had all of my lists and my reasons of why Claire was so wrong, and why I knew I was right, and I had, you know, done all my character work, and then I had to flip it and play Claire after I had already judged her so harshly. And so I couldn't come up with the reasons, oh, she's manipulative, she's, you know, a B word, she's all this other stuff, and I had to come up with reasons as to why she's doing this and why she feels the way she feels. Why is she so manipulative, and why is power, why does it mean so much to her? You know, where has she been neglected in her life that has caused her to have this power mm-hmm. struggle that she needs? And so when I flipped it and flipped my psyche and my thinking, then I was able to understand Claire a little bit more, because if I came at her judging her, then I would never be able to, you know, to play her, because I'm thinking the worst of her. So when I broke down the reasons as to why she's doing this, which is a lot of it is because of neglect. You know, she's been neglected in her homeroom and abandoned by her father. And so all of these, you know, reasons, and being the only child and having everything but not having that genuine love from your father, and wanting to seek power. It's all about power for Clara, you know. Then I was able to play her. And so then it became fun. It was like, okay, I understand why she's doing this, so I can have fun in being – and being mean and being ruthless, because I am, okay. You know.
You're mean and ruthless.
My juices are flowing right now. I'm ready to go. Let's get on with this. Back to Rhonda. You know, we have George wrote a woman's, let's call it a woman's play. He likes to write about women. I did, I produced a reading last year. And
of the Kush.
Of the Kush. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I loved about it was that it was a melodrama, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, the history of the sorority and the fraternity, excuse me, the sorority, wasn't that important to me. It was a melodrama. And the Rhonda character, I was just sitting here right now, and it reminds me of melodrama, you know, it's melodramatic from the 40s, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm thinking about, I'm going to name off male characters now. I mean, it's like there's a film called The Oxbow Incident, mm-hmm. and it's about a lynching.
Henry Fonda,
Dana Andrews, and Anthony Quinn, and so on and so forth. And the person that is totally right in this film is the one that gets lynched. And it's almost as if I saw that. I mean, you're the, you know, I mean, it's like,
yeah,
and you're yanked out of the group. Mm-hmm. The crucible mm-hmm. kind of comes to mind when somebody says this isn't right, this is wrong.
Yeah,
it's you know, I've been in situations where I was like the dissenting vote.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me get back to Alicia for some final comments before we let her go, and then we'll come back to her. You have any final comments, Alicia?
Yes. Make sure that everyone comes out to Stella Adler this weekend on the corner of Hollywood and Highland. Yes, there's some traffic, but get there early so you can have a great seat at 8 p.m. on Friday and Saturday, and then for a great matinee on Sunday with a Q&A following, which was very successful last week. And we also have a great reception coming up this Saturday as well to celebrate everyone that's coming. We just really appreciate the audience that we've been blessed with. I know, I'm sure Charlotte agrees. We've had some great people coming out, and I anticipate that this weekend is going to be the biggest crowd.
Me too. I think
so too. I know personally me, I'm bringing the most people that I've been able to bring.
Same.
I'm going to bring more than you bring.
Thank you. All right.
Yes.
Thank you, Alicia. Alicia Murray. Thank you very much for calling
us. Guys. Of course.
Mm-hmm. Have a good day.
Okay, now I want to get into, you know, Josh, it's something that always stuck. Maybe we can get into a discussion about that. And I thought about one of the arcs in Clara's character I don't want to say it bothered me, but I want to get a little bit more clarification. Mm-hmm. It's when she's talking to Rhonda in one of the bedroom scenes. Mm-hmm. And she's talking about the incident with her father. Mm-hmm. And her father, you know, the scenario and all of that. And then immediately she shifts to the boyfriend. Mm-hmm. And that was hard for me to kind of put that together. Can either one of you comment on that? And then
either one? Which might.
That means he wants both of you to comment.
Let George go, and then I'll play
what I do. Okay.
You know what portion I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was 180. That mm-hmm. was the major beat.
Change, yeah.
big beat. Mm-hmm. In my mind, when I was writing this, for Clara to operate as a human being, she's not a psychopath, but she has her demons. And she's learned to deal with them, in a sense, with compartmentalization. She'll take and put it in this box. I can deal with that and focus on this. This was her way of shifting gears, in my mind, immediately to get away from something painful to something that was totally different and positive. She had mm-hmm. her emotions engaged by Barry, totally different from her interaction with her biological father. This was a very painful incident, as she relayed it to Rhonda, mm-hmm. and she's put it to bed. That's the end of it. I wanted to think of something positive, and mm-hmm. the most positive thing that has impacted is this sudden love or lust for Barry, you mm-hmm. know, and people do that in real life. This switch from one mood immediately to another. But it's usually driven by some need to get away from the subject mm-hmm. into something else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
I think when you have a guy that you like, that you're in love with, that you're infatuated with, the first person you want to tell is your best friend. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. I think Clara, I don't think she goes into the scene, you know, I'm going to tell Rhonda about Barry, but eventually the situation, the conversation leads to her revealing about her father, which I don't think that she wanted to bring up at all. But they have been best friends for 4 years. So they've developed, you know, they're seniors in college. So they developed a friendship, and that now I feel like she feels that she can expose a little bit of herself. But once it gets too tough, that mask, like George said, has to come back up. That wall has to come back up. And a wall that she doesn't mind revealing with Rhonda is the Barry, you know, the bear, her infatuation with Barry. And I think that she thinks that, you know, Rhonda would understand her infatuation for this guy if she knows that she's half white, you know what I mean? And that she does have a white father, you know, that Rhonda would be a little bit more understanding instead of Rhonda judging, you know.
I got a question. Okay.
Creative juices flowing.
Yeah, I told you. Is this a, you know, I'm not going to describe the scene because it's kind of surprising.
Right.
I don't want to put a spoiler. You got to come to the show.
Right.
But there's a I think George put this scene in later after we had the reading. And it's brief, but we see Carla's explosion about Kathy. You know, she feels haunted by Kathy almost. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to touch on, ask George, what made you put that in, and then how did you, you know, interpret it, and what was your interpretation of the scene? She felt like she was being haunted almost by the presence of this woman.
You're talking about the portion at the end of the portion with the coach,
the photograph,
the
photograph.
Okay.
Hey, I want Charlotte to answer first. Whatever she says,
I'm going to go with it.
I'm on spoiler. The photograph scene. Yeah,
the photograph scene. Okay. You know, she enters into that space thinking, okay, Barry, it's going to be me and him, and it's going to be great. And she already knows that this girl has pledged. And so she already is feeling like, okay, a white girl coming into this space. So a guard's already up. But you know what? Who puts her guard down and makes her feel better? Barry. So we're going into this place with a sense of excitement and, you know, love and hearts and flowers. And then she sees her again. And like you said, it is like she's being haunted. And she's trying, I think she would have pounced on her earlier, but because of the coach is in the scene and in the room, she's a lady, you know, and she's like, George, she's not a psychopath. She's going to maintain her composure.
We'll get to that soon.
Yeah. Sociopath.
So she has to maintain her composure. But as soon as the both of them leave, that rage has been building up the whole time that they are in the room. And so as soon as he closes the door, she can release the frustration that she has had. And then she sees it again in a photograph. And so for me, that was it, because I felt that going in, I'm going in with love and excitement. And then I see something that totally catches me off guard. It's like being punched in the face. Mm-hmm. And I have to maintain my composure because of who I'm around. But as soon as they leave, I have to explode. You know, it's like a volcano that needs to erupt. Mm-hmm. And so that's where that comes from. Yeah.
Look, tell us a little about your background and how you got off into acting.
Yeah.
Get into that for a minute.
Okay, I started off with acting when I was like 7 years old. I started off into background. My dad actually randomly heard, you know, taking background on the radio. And so he had my mom take me to this place, and they were looking for background actors. And I did background for about 2 years and became a part of SAG from doing background because I spoke.
At seven?
At seven, yes. It was nothing but God. But I spoke on a film set, spoke to the lead actor, and I was not supposed to speak, but the director liked it, and I became a must join right away. And then I kept with film from probably like 7 to 10. And then when I went to middle school, I just did strictly theater. Still did a little film gigs here and there, but I had a really great drama program at Dana Middle School in Hawthorne. And so I found my love for the live stage, you know, from being on stage and getting that high from the audience. The audience just adds so much to the play. Like, they are truly another role mm-hmm. in the play.
Without a doubt.
I fell in love with that. So I went to Los Angeles County High School for the Arts, where I studied theater and continued to perfect that craft. And then I got into the BFA program at Cal State Fullerton. So I've been done for 3 years now, and still doing film, because I do love film. Mm-hmm. But I love theater, so I'm doing both. I'm living the LA mm-hmm. dream of doing both film and theater. That's kind of how I got my start. Yeah.
I want to play a clip from veteran stage and screen actor David McKnight on the advice that he gave to young actors about trying to break into the business.
Awesome.
Understand the connectivity of each of those characters based on August Wilson's writing and a good director who, you know, mm-hmm. directed us toward that idea.
Mm-hmm. And you had a powerful lead actor also who you worked with before.
Yeah, my good friend Charlie Robinson, yeah, mm-hmm. great actor, you know, and I love working with him. I worked with him before. And I have a lot of admiration and respect for his talent. It was good working with him. We had some good scenes together.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think you've already answered this, but I'm going to throw it out again. What advice would you give young actors, especially African Americans, trying to break into the business?
I want to say that a buddy of mine brought his son to me. His son was about 12 years old. My son wants to be an actor, you know. I said, what can you tell him to do? I said, first thing I told him, get a dictionary. Okay? Get a dictionary. He said, oh, yeah, get a dictionary. He said, well, he got the computer. I said, good, stay on that computer. Because as an actor, this is one thing. You get scripts, you get stories, and you get writers. You, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, you're an excellent writer, okay? And you know a lot of words. You know what I mean? Because you studied. Right? And a lot of writers are brilliant writers. August Wilson, they know a lot of different words. We're not close to all those words, but we got to understand those words. So, and that's one thing. You cannot, as an actor, go in auditioning or doing a play and not understanding the meaning of those words. I mean, mm-hmm. thoroughly, completely. That is your responsibility. You got to know that. So first thing I tell a young person, you know, starting off, of course, go to college, get as much education as you can, but get a dictionary, go to the computer, and understand that you got to know those words and break those words down. I've done plays with actors that can't pronounce the words, don't know the definition of the words and can't pronounce the words. That's a big, big, huge mistake.
Yeah.
You follow me?
Problem.
Because, I mean, these especially writers in Hollywood, a lot of these writers in Hollywood and the Writers Guild and so forth, these are very brilliant, educated people. They come up with some words I never could imagine I'd ever heard. What the heck does that word mean? So I got to give respect to that and go to that computer, go to that dictionary, and get a good, clear understanding of the definition and pronunciation of that word. Right. So I can say to young people trying to make it in the business, you know, understand that you must educate yourself in all aspects of training that you can. You can do dance, you can do it. Everything you can learn to do is going to be good for your acting. Dancing, singing, mime, you know, mm-hmm. juggling, everything that you can do. Learn to do a whole lot of things. Riding a motorcycle, riding a bicycle, roller skating, ice skating, swimming. Everything you can do to enhance that instrument, if your body is your instrument. You learn how to use that instrument in many kind of ways. Kung mm-hmm. fu, karate, everything you can do. You know, poetry, all kinds of stuff. You know what I mean? Don't be afraid to go venture out and learn things to enhance your instrument.
Okay. Let's get some comments on that. Start with George and go around. From George to Charlotte to Kurt.
Okay.
Let's start with George.
Well, that was intriguing, the emphasis on word usage. I'm not so sure I spend a lot of time thinking of exotic words. I do think word placement within the context of dramatic elements of the play and dialogue.
Well, you had that word in phone booth, that crazy word.
Well, that was the name of my relative. That wasn't a common word. What Cromwell, chronic, yeah. Tendrils, Manders.
Oh, dear.
What a name. Anyway, I think the context and the variation, the various interpretation of a word, because the actor can be thinking, that's the first definition I see in the dictionary, but that's not the necessarily context. What I was thinking. I was thinking about the third definition of that word. So I think the probing, the understanding of the variation of the words themselves plays a major role.
Charlotte.
Yeah, I completely agree with what David McKnight had to say about actors developing their craft as far as doing singing and dance, you know, and horseback riding and ice skating, because yes, we're actors, but when you have to play a role of a person who is a boxer or a person, you know, who is a professional skilled at riding horses, you know, it's nice if you already have some type of training in that area. It's especially with dance and singing, like that is super big now. I'm actually pushing my envelope and taking hip hop classes and dance and vocal lessons because I want to be that actor. You know, when it says, okay, we just need you to sing this, or you got to do a little two step, I'm not so terrified of it, you know. I'm like, George has me singing at the end of the Kush, and I was like, wait a minute. But, you know, we worked it out. You know, it's cool. So I agree completely.
Okay, Kurt.
I want to drift away from words for a minute, and I'll end up with words. So I'm just going to tell you advice somebody gave to me when I was in grad school, and I got my master's degree in screenwriting and motion communications, screenwriting and filmmaking. My mentor was a gentleman who served in the Navy for about 36 years. He was a China sailor. A China sailor was like Steve McQueen in the Sand Pebbles. He'd just go up and down the rivers in China, and he never saw the United States. So this man was a China sailor. And then he became a boxer. And then he did other things, and he became a screenwriter, and he wrote a screenplay with Cary Grant in it where there was a submarine and they painted it pink. I can't think of the name of it.
Yeah, I remember.
Okay. Yep. He told me, and I think this is something everybody should think about. He told me, get a job. He told me about Anthony Trollope. Mm-hmm. He told me about Charles Dickens. And these guys were like businessmen. Mm-hmm. They had full-time jobs and they wrote in the evening. He said, get a job that you can pay your bills with, that you can go get a six-pack of beer at the end of the week and go see some movies and do some writing, every night. Mm-hmm. And I think that the same thing can be applied to actors. Anybody who's going to be artistic, when it comes to words, as a playwright, it does bother me that people come in unprepared and don't know how to pronounce a word. You know, and it's doubly so if I've sent you clips from YouTube where you see the person giving the speech, and you know you have it, you know, but you have to prepare yourself as an actor.
Okay, let's do. I'm on another clip. I asked David about what is his approach for learning lines for actors. Let's play this with David.
Something else, David. What is your process for learning lines?
Oh, boy, that's a good one. That's a good question. You know, I go to the bottom line and say by rote, you know, and that is by doing the best that you can by any way, any means necessary.
Repetition.
Oh, absolutely, by rote. But also what it depends on is the individual. Some actors, individuals, have photographic memories. Some actors, individuals, don't have. They have a semi-photographic memory. some actors, individuals, and they have talent, but they don't have good memory skills. So depending upon what your level is, depends upon what you're going to have to do in order to learn those lines. Now, if you have a photographic memory, they come to you as a snap. But if you recognize the fact, well, I'm a slow learner, it takes me a while, then that means you got a woodshed. You got to start early and dig deep. You know what I mean? And you do it by every means necessary. You could, you know, say them over and over and over and over and over, day and night, morning, noon and night. You can write them down, take them, write it in pencil over and over and over. Because when you take a pencil and write something down, it does enhance your memory a little bit more than just speaking it out.
Mm-hmm, with a pencil.
With a pencil in your hand, you just write those lines out and you try to do it from memory. First, you can do it by just looking at the script and then writing it out verbatim as you're reading it from the script. And there's something about that hand, the pencil in your hand, mind, pencil contact, and writing will dig it a little bit deeper into your memory. You do that, then you can put it on tape. You put it on tape and you can listen to it over and over and over. Then, like a lot of my actor friends and myself, what we do, we go to the park. We go out by the ocean or something, and we get out there and speak out those lines. You know what I'm talking about. Speak those lines over and over and over. You whisper those lines. You sing those lines. You do everything you can. When I was starting out as an actor, one of the things that I enjoyed doing, what I would try to find every aspect of how I could perform my lines. I sing my lines, I laugh my lines, I get angry with all my lines, everything. I'm angry all through every line in it. I laugh at every line, I sing every line, you know, I clown every line. I do everything because, let me share this with you, and I do coach actors. One of the things that we do as actors, our bodies are our instrument. Every aspect of our body is our instrument. We don't, you know, if you're a piano player, your piano is your instrument. Mm-hmm. If you're a horn player, horn is your instrument. But see, our bodies are our instrument. So that means it's our ears, our eyes, our voice, you know, our energy, everything, you know, our mannerisms, movements, and everything else. So we have to train that instrument, and we have to work with that instrument. Mm-hmm. And so you take that instrument and put it in all kinds of technique and environments that you can in order to be able to use it when the time is necessary. Mm-hmm. But getting back to remembering those lines, you just do it over and over and over and over and over until you got it.
Okay, Charlotte.
Yes.
Let you comment on that.
I agree completely. Definitely repetition helps me learn my lines. But also, I find that I can't just... I need to know the intent. Why am I saying what I'm saying? And once I put the intention behind that line, the line comes easier to me because I know why I'm saying it. And then sometimes I can learn the line and I'm driving and I'm good. It's all in my head. But then when I get on stage and I feel that connection to the other person, whoop, it goes out the window. And so that tells me that it's in my head and the lines aren't in my body. Like they're not a part of me yet. They haven't come together. So working out while learning your lines is also a really good tool, because then if you can learn your lines while doing push-ups and you know it because your body is distracted doing something else, but you're still connected and you're still feeling it, you know. And even running lines with your scene partner is an awesome thing, because you have that connection and you have that person that is feeding you. Mm-hmm. And then you know the intention of why you're saying that line. And so the line just becomes, it's not even a line anymore. I need to say this. You know, it's conversation. So.
Okay. Yeah, so we got about a minute each comment. Mm-hmm. George.
Yeah, I was just going to say that today, because of your cell phone, you don't have to worry about being perceived as mentally ill if you're walking on the pier talking to yourself,
yes,
because they assume
yes.
you're on the phone
yes.
and you're doing your lines.
I actually do that. I put headphones in my headphones in my phone, and I will say my lines, people don't even think about it. But if I, you know, I'm walking by myself without like my phone, it looks a little weird. But I put my headphones in, and I'm good.
We got about a minute of closing comments, Kurt.
Yeah. First of all, everybody needs to go out and see this play.
Please.
I saw a photo of Charlotte on the Daughters of the Kush website, and I didn't know if it was Charlotte or not. I but I saw a photo. You're sitting on the bed, and the body is an instrument. I saw just the way you were sitting there with the cigarette, and I said, I got to go see this person in this role. Yeah. So quickly, I would like to ask you, do you have any favorite actresses?
Yes. Viola Davis, hands down. Mm. I love her truth that she brings on the stage and with the character and that she brings off stage. You know, I don't know her personally, but the interviews that I watch of her, she has this, and that's what I always try to find in my characters, the truth. Why is this person doing this? How can I ground this person and make this person relatable? Because this person is somebody, you know, and she can relate to somebody. And Viola Davis always finds the truth, no matter how absurd her characters are. She grounds them in truth, and I adore her.
Okay. Very, very, very interesting discussion. Our next broadcast is on Thursday, November the 9th, 11 o'clock. We'll be talking about economics in the black community. We'll discuss Marcus Garvey, economic philosopher, Harold Cruz, Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Dr. Claude Anderson. And that's on the 9th of November, Thursday. A special thanks to Kirk Maxey, George Corbin, Charlotte Williams, on the line with Alicia Murray. Please listen to past shows of the Qumran Report by Googling in Qumran Report. Thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report. And from your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, may the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. I leave you with Homeboy by Sunchi Ali.
There's only one blood, cause it ain't no sense in us trampling on the stones. It's us, down to the bone. Blood is thick, waters were known well, cousins were kept apart, mothers were often memories. Fathers were not favorites on the farm, for he could do some harm, he could wreck the master scheme, for he, brothers, could dream. Your mama ain't no saint, your daddy died.